tonight. As we make the switch over, next up we're going to hear from Allison Osterberg and Kevin Hansen. Allison is a senior planner with Thurston County. She focuses on environmental planning and growth management issues. Kevin, also at Thurston County, is county hydrogeologist. He has 36 years of experience with hydrogeology, water resource evaluations, and environmental restoration. And maybe during a poster gala later, you can ask him about his one U.S. patent.
So good afternoon. I think they had us go toward the end of the day because they thought water discussion will really get people going. So I'm Allison Osterberg. I'm a planner with Thurston County, and Kevin Hansen and I are going to switch up for this talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about what is the Hearst decision for folks who haven't been following it on a day-to-day basis, like myself, and why does it matter to us in the South Sound? How has Thurston County responded to the Hearst decision? And how can scientific data inform what happens next? I know we've had a lot of science folks in the room, and this is more of a policy discussion. And so unfortunately, for my part of the talk at least, instead of getting cool pictures of creepy kelp crabs and seals with computers strapped to their backs, you get pictures of words. I do want to give a few caveats. This is Kevin and I are speaking for ourselves as a county planner and hydrogeologist, and we don't speak for other participants in these processes, and we don't speak for, we speak as technical experts for the county, and we don't speak for the Board of County Commissioners. I say this because everybody has an opinion about the Hearst decision and about groundwater issues, and I also want to emphasize that we're not legal experts on water law, and I'm going to talk a little bit about water law. And many of you in the audience may know more about it than me, so I apologize if I mangle it. And I emphasize that, in fact, because as soon as people hear that I'm working on this, I start getting calls from lawyers. So what is the Hearst decision? It was a state Supreme Court decision that came down just about 2 years ago, almost exactly. And the court case itself was Whatcom County versus Hearst, FutureWise, and others. In that ruling, the court ruled that Whatcom County failed to comply with the Growth Management Act in protecting water resources. And that ruling required that Whatcom County make an independent decision about legal water availability. When people talk about the Hearst decision, they often say it's that decision about water rights, and I would say that the Hearst decision is not really about water rights. Primarily, Hearst is a growth management requirement. And I'll talk a little bit about why I see it that way. When people think about our regulatory structure, and all of us who work in science and in Puget Sound in these areas work within this regulatory structure, sometimes all these pieces just work together seamlessly, and all of our laws just work together in this beautiful whole. But in fact, it often, the regulatory background looks a lot like this. It's messy. The gears don't all work together perfectly. Many of these laws were developed at different times for different purposes and are often being made to apply today to situations that are very different than the conditions that existed when they were developed. Sometimes the rules overlap, and sometimes they leave gaps in between them. And the Hearst decision emphasizes a gap between two of our big pieces of Washington state law, the Water Code, which is RCW 9003, and the Growth Management Act, which is 3670A. The Water Code was developed in 1916 during the pioneer days of Washington state, and this is definitely the philosophy that's embedded in this law. There's a sense of Western expansion, and the idea in it is that you're concerned with using resources up as fast as possible. And so the concept that's embedded in the Water Code is first in time, first in right. You got there first, it's yours, use it or lose it. The Growth Management Act, by contrast, was developed at a time when the state was recognizing that we have scarcity of our resources and that we have these multiple goals that can be in conflict for each other, and they're really that we could use them all up and not have anything left for the future. So the Growth Management Act is all about planning for the future. Just to dive into that a little bit more, the water code says that water belongs to the public and its use is regulated and controlled by the state. The authority for appropriating the water was given to the Department of Ecology in 1970. It was other agencies before that. And you get a right from the state to use that water if you are putting it to a beneficial use. So you're using it to improve the land by making it suitable for human habitation, for such as agriculture, you're building a home, that sort of thing. And it says it right there, the first in time shall be the first in right. So if we're talking about first, who got there first, I think our speakers just previously and at the welcome today spoke very movingly about how tribes in this area have been using water since time immemorial and have rights to that use as well. And when we look at the regulatory structure, even within our law, our legal system, a lot of those rights date back to treaties that were signed in the 1850s. In Thurston County, if we look at this area then, by 1910, we had a lot more Western European settlement, a lot of agriculture that was happening. And already by that time, though, we were seeing a draw on resources. This is a picture of Scatter Creek, which is down by Rochester. And you can see that you have people standing in the middle of the stream because it's pretty dry. We started seeing this increasingly, and that led to the development of people started recognizing that we may be over-appropriating this water, and that led to the closure of basins beginning in Thurston County in 1950 with the closure of the Scatter Creek Basin to new surface water withdrawals. And the pink dots that are in this map, this is all Thurston County, if folks aren't aware, and that orange area is the Scatter Creek Basin, which is down in the Chehalis. And the dots are kind of larger wells. Over time, this expanded to other areas. In 1960, we're seeing more and more basins that are closed to new surface water withdrawals. And as this continued, and we also see more wells, more development, more people are living here, and that it occurred to folks at some point that we could appropriate all the water for use and not leave any of it in streams, and that wouldn't be too good for fish. And so that led to the development of a particular type of water right, which is an in-stream flow rule. And state law requires that there be enough water retained in streams and rivers to protect and preserve in-stream resources, which include fish habitat, but also things like recreation and navigation. And the main thing to remember about an in-stream flow rule is that they're set at a certain time, and they're in that structure of the water code. They get a place in line. Their first in time is first in right, and they've got that place before and after others. And by 1990, in-stream flow rules have covered all of Thurston County. And that's great. Everybody's got a place in line, right? And we've got these rules in place. But there is an exceptions in the water code, and that's where when people talk about permit-exempt wells, that's what those are. The idea was that small uses of water don't need to come in. They still get a place in line, but they don't need to go through a water right development process. And a single-family well is one of those permit-exempt uses. So we've been talking about the water code. And in general, the water code just says, it's mine, I got here first, it's all mine. And meanwhile, in Thurston, throughout Washington, we were developing this whole other regulatory structure around growth management, which was around, let's share what we have today with the future. And let's think about that in advance. And one thing that the Growth Management Act says is that we have to develop a land use element, and as part of that element, we have to provide for the protection of quality and quantity of groundwater use for public water supplies. And we really have to look at how our uses and our planned uses of these resources are going to affect our goals that we have for the community around the environment, but also around housing and transportation and natural resources and private property rights and all of these multiple benefits, multiple things that we all want to be a part of our community as we look ahead in the next decades. And Thurston County is one of the fastest growing areas of Washington. You can see here that our population is projected to grow by, give or take 100,000 people, which is like if everybody from the city of Redmond moved to Thurston County over the next 20 years. Could be more, could be less, but around that. And that's a 42% increase overall. And another way to look at that, if you break out that growth into where it might be located, More than half of it would be in the cities. That's the gray area on the bottom. And then the red and the blue are the urban areas that are around the cities where the cities might grow into. And that's what we like to see under the Growth Management Act. Urban development and urban areas, most of the population located where there are services. That yellow triangle, the yellow slice is 14% that would be located in the rural county based on the projections that we have. And it's only that triangle that would most likely be relying on permit-exempt wells. Folks who are living in the other parts most likely would be hooked up to a public water source, a city municipal source. So when you just, for background for people who don't come in and get building permits all the time, if you come into the county, we issue building permits. We don't issue well permits. And if you want to build a home, you have to let us know that you're going to have a water supply before we'll give you a building permit. And that's what we call a certificate of water availability. And traditionally, we look to make sure that you were locating your well in a safe place, that you weren't, you know, for instance, putting it into your septic system, and that that it had good quality and that it had enough water coming out of it. We weren't looking at legally how might you be affecting other water right users, because that was ecology's responsibility. Yeah, you get your permit. After HRSC came down, what it required is it said the county needs to make an independent determination of water availability that's separate from what ecology has done. And that led to a lot of questions. How exactly do we do that? And many jurisdictions around Washington State reacted to that decision in different ways. And Thurston County reacted a different way. And Kevin's going to talk a little bit about the really extensive monitoring. We really wanted to get a better understanding about what is the groundwater situation in Thurston County. And Kevin's going to talk about that.
So this, thank you, Allison. Thank you, everybody, for having us here today. This HRSC decision hit us like a bolt of lightning. Counties all over the state stopped issuing building permits for rural development. It was a big deal, okay? Shut the legislature down for months. And our county said, okay, what do we know? I trotted out a map, and the map had an earlier version of this on it. Now, every one of those little orange dots up there is a well scaled in area by its pumping rate in acre feet per year, total annual pumping. So that didn't exist 2.5 years ago. To our knowledge, there was no centralized source. So we thought, we need to do our due diligence. What is actually happening? So the county was doing business as usual, issuing rural building permits, while we collected data and did analysis. But one of the things that popped out from this whole process that you see represented by those dots is we started to get a sense of who was using water for what purpose. And the purposes were really revelatory, okay? So let me go on now to a count here. Just so you know, we found around 22,500 pumping wells. We had to compile 11 different data sources or so. We're still finding them. Like, this gets updated. This is version number 37, something like that. Of those, almost 21,000 are so-called permit exempt. Those are the little tiny grains of sand, the little tiny dots that you see up there. So remember the slides, a few slides back, when Allison showed all the basins being closed, in air quotes, back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s? Oh, 50s through the 90s, I'm sorry. They weren't closed. There was an exception. And the exception was permit-exempt wells. So one of the reactions to this denial of water rights for most situations was you can drill a permit-exempt well. It was still okay. So boy, did people go to town drilling permit-exempt wells. That became one of the preferred rural methods of getting a water supply. So after we got a sense of where the pumping was, we started compiling all the hydrogeologic studies. And it turns out we were overwhelmed with studies. We had more data than we realized. And today, here, you see a part of the surfeit of data that's out there. There is so much information. But it's these towers of knowledge. And many of those towers of knowledge are not connected to public policy very tightly right now. So one of the things we tried to do was bring together all the studies. So the studies you see compiled here were 11 different, yeah, I think it was 11, not 10 different studies, of gaining and losing streams. Every broad band you see represents the amount of water coming into a stream or leaving a stream. So the green bands are gaining water, just like you'd expect in a wet climate. The red and orange bands are losing water. Now, why in a wet climate would a stream lose water? Why would it have less water? Well, somebody's taking it out of the stream. It's losing water for a reason. So what are the reasons? That could be a water right, could be a senior withdrawer. Many of the ones that you see, the red band in the middle is central Thurston County, and a lot of the loss in the Deschutes River, shown where that long red stripe is, that is loss from base flow pumping. Okay, that's base flow loss from big pumping centers. That's a big deal. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the big reasons. And if you see a hydrogeologic model, you will see the streamlines feeding a well at my shoulder. The streamlines will extend back up right to the bottom of the river, and it's like a leech stuck onto the bottom of that river. That's the well draining the stream. That's the well draining the stream. The initial concept of water law in Washington State viewed groundwater and surface water as largely two different things. They're not. It's the same water. It's the same water. And that simple thing requires repetition after repetition because people think that streams flow because it just rained. But you have to ask yourself a basic question. Why is there water in a stream when it isn't raining? Why? Well, the answer is largely base flow seepage from groundwater. Largely. Okay? So that simple thing required all kinds of internal and external repetition and explanation. But it led to an ability to create what we've got now, which is up here a big tool, a big model that we built over most of the county's acreage. And we're using that to do some forward prediction, although this is steady state, and we want to go next. And I have to say, hooray, I love the Squaxin Island Tribe for having invited us to participate in a grant through the BIA to help develop more information about recharge in the Deschutes Basin. And I hope to extend that countywide. So we now have tools and data that we didn't have 2 years ago. Now, what did it say? This is the sort of bottom line chart that if you remember one thing from my part of this, I'd ask you to remember this chart. Those colored bands represent the cumulative total groundwater impact, groundwater pumping. Cumulative total groundwater pumping in acre feet per year from all that research we did. The big blue band at the beginning is the main public water supply systems, the Group A systems, followed by the orange-red band, which is irrigation. Next was the real startling one, fish production. Astounding volumes of water pumped for fish production. Then that sort of yellowish band to the generally far right, that little tiny band represents the cumulative pumping from those 20,880 permit-exempt wells. All of those wells and that little band. So now you begin to see something which is pretty interesting. Vina, are we okay on time? Okay. So despite all the huzzah about Hearst, it only affects a relatively small part of the total water budget. And then you come through all the other uses, commercial, industrial, Group B systems, things like that, to the very thin little fingernail. Fill your fingernail. That's how many wells every year we're permitting as a part of rural permit-exempt wells right now. It's not very many. Maybe 100 to 500, depending on the economy. Varies a lot with the economy. The bill that was passed, ESSB 6091, affects essentially only those tiny wells at the very end. So the conditions we face now are the result of cumulative effects. And one of the takeaways for me is our county must work closely with all of the actors in this water budget summary. This is a big deal. I have to work with them. There is no future without working with everybody together. I think there may even be a place for a new dialogue, although Allison's going to come back to what we're doing about this right now. It's very interesting. So, you want to talk 6091? Okay.
So the legislature did pass a bill in January, ESSB 6091, and that kind of has short-term and long-term effects. One of the main things that it did is that it clearly shifted that responsibility back to ecology. The county can issue building permits, but the condition for that, without doing a whole different assessment, that's what it says for now. It's kind of a pause. One of the things that we're waiting for is through these watershed planning groups looking at different ways to work out actions that can mitigate for impacts from new development on permit exempt wells. And those watershed planning groups, and we have them for all five of the watersheds that we have in Thurston County, are to develop lists of actions that will get us there. So how can science inform those actions and those policies?
Okay, so you see that? That may be the most confusing graphic you'll see today, and it's deliberately that way, well, accidentally deliberately. That is the place of use polygon map for a section of Thurston County surrounding Black Lake. So each of those little colored polygons represents the single place of use for a water right. It includes Squaxin Island. I didn't have time to include Chehalis and the other rights in there, but it includes Squaxin Island rights. You can see it as a hatch pattern. So try to debug that and figure out at the level of an individual application who's got what rights. It is extremely difficult. And this is sort of our next big hurdle, is to figure out who's got legal availability, because the legal availability question is huge. And I'll pose it to you this way. You see that center bar? That's what I showed a minute ago, that long graph. That's another representation of it simplified. Below it, sort of grayed out because it's conceptual, is a smaller bar. And that smaller bar is what I'll call sustainable. Because if our basins are stressed out right now, and our streams are stressed out right now, and our stream flows are too low right now, it's got to be something less than we're already doing. This is my sort of generalist conclusion. But the upper bar, above the middle one, the upper bar, that represents the expansion to serve 100,000 new people and the legal right to water to do it. Now, only a few people have enough legal water to support 100,000 new people. Where is it going to come from? So let's just summarize. Ready? Here's sustainable. Here's where we are. Here's legal water to grow into with 100,000 new people. We're going that way. We probably need to go that way. Okay, that's the simplistic view of this slide. So we've got a mitigation project we're going to apply for grant funding under, and what you see is the cyclic, repetitive input of stormwater, where we're going to use stormwater to recharge an aquifer near Rochester. The red is when that stormwater begins to appear in the Black River, and that's beneficial. So there are projects that can be helpful, but it is not easy.
Okay, so takeaways. So we've come a long way. We know a lot more than we did, but there's a lot more work to do. At Thurston County, we're very committed to participating in these watershed planning efforts. We think there's a real opportunity in this bill, even though it is limited, to work together and to think about these things in a new way. But it is very complicated to try to understand connections between groundwater and surface water in individual homes. One thing we need to do is find the balance between getting really good data that can inform our policies and taking action in a timely manner while it still matters. So we could spend decades, as many communities in Eastern Washington have, getting this down to very, very a micro understanding about all these interactions, and that might be really great, and it might take us a long time to get a single new drop of water back in the streams. So we got to find a balance between having good data and using it to develop good policies in a timely manner. And we really need to look at finding policy solutions that are equitable, and equitable across different areas. That means between different users of water. And then sometimes I hear a lot of things of people wanting to put all the costs of this on these new people who are coming in, new developers, that it should cost more to drill a well or to do development. But I think all of us want to live in a community where it's affordable for our children to grow up and buy homes and live here and have a good quality of life. And just shifting all of those costs onto the people who aren't here yet, that's the paradigm, and that's in the water code. I'm already here, and I've got my water, so I'm good. And if you came later, too bad for you. So what I think we are really saying is let's share. Let's find a way that we can share both between the people who are here who are water users today and the ones who aren't here who don't even know what a wonderful place this is to live in. We want them to be able to have good water. We want them to be able to come and experience what it's like to have healthy salmon runs and clean water and all those things. We need to share between today and tomorrow. And we also need to share among ourselves in this room. There's such an incredible wealth of knowledge from all of these different disciplines. And the thing that, this region of the United States knows so much about stormwater and habitat and all those things, a lot of those solutions could also benefit stream flows. And how, you know, I would challenge everyone here to think about the work that they do. How could it be engaged to solve this crucial problem? Because water is just one of those fundamental things that I think we all care about. And that's all I've got. Thank you.
All right, questions for Allison and Kevin? We have one over here.
Thanks for that great presentation. Question to both of you. Do you know of parallel work going on in Pierce or Mason County?
Yes, actually, both Pierce and Mason County are going to be engaged in these watershed planning efforts. The law that I mentioned identifies different watersheds throughout Washington that have to do planning efforts. I can't remember off the top of my head how many each of the other ones have. I know Pierce is engaged in the Nisqually process, which is one of the fastest ones that's happening, and in several of their other watersheds. And Mason County, I know, will be engaged in WIRA 14, the Kennedy-Goldsboro area, and I'm not sure if they have another one. They might. So, yes.
That might be a report for next year.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you guys have thought about how beavers could actually be a part of the solution. Are you a beaver believer? I see one up there. So they're really important in creation and maintenance of wetland habitat, and they're really also really important for groundwater recharge. And we have a new regulation here in Western Washington that allows beavers to actually be relocated to areas where we can, you know, show through feasibility studies that they might improve habitat and be welcome. And I just am wondering if you guys have explored that at all.
Yeah, I've heard much about beavers. Folks are talking about it a lot. Riparian corridor restoration, basically storing water in the floodplain using beaver-built structures, and the whole ecosystem that comes with beavers is a fabulous opportunity, and I'd urge people to think it out, okay? There are lots of ways beavers can be very helpful.
Thanks, Scott. Kevin, I was really taken with your simplifications of the system. I think it makes a lot of sense to try to present it to people that way, because as you showed with your other slides, it's extremely complicated when you look at all the details of water rights, in-stream flows, and what the models show. I did want to add a little bit of a comment. I apologize if there's anybody here from the City of Seattle Water Department, but back in the 1980s, the City of Seattle was bent on getting more water rights to serve their growing population in not only Seattle, but of course in most of King County. And they had closed basins already at that point. And what they said was, well, water use is inelastic, i.e. the more people we have, the more water we're going to have to use. And we said, we don't believe that. You're going to have to prove that to us. And they went to work and actually found that they could do a lot of things to conserve water. And if you've heard them speak in the last few years, they are very proud of the fact that they have their population has increased by many, many hundreds of thousands of people, and they're today using about 30% less water than they used 20 years ago. So I say that to point out that that 100,000 people doesn't necessarily mean that we need to use more water. In fact, if we're smart about it, we'll end up using less water. It's just a matter of figuring out how to get there. What are the incentives? What are the different things we can build into our infrastructure that will help us to use less water in the future than we've used in the past?
Thanks, Dave. I hope you're participating on some of these groups.
That's actually a really good segue into my question. And so when developing the allocations for... When developing the allocations for how much the permit exempt wells are pulling out of your model, is that based on metered pumping data, or is that based on the 5,000 gallon per day exemption?
So your point is, your point's really important. And I would point out that our current assumption, the assumption I've been using and we've been using for planning, is a quarter of an acre foot per year per domestic connection, typical average. We have boosted that wherever we had a bedroom count that we knew to be larger from our own permitting database, and we boosted it yet further when we had Group A or B system data from DOH or some other reliable entity that knew more about population being served by that connection. So we do have that default. Now, all of our forecasting is being done on the quarter-acre foot basis, which is a pretty solid number based on pretty reliable information. There's this thing about, will the water return via septic, and does that subtract from the total consumption? We've been saying, we don't know. We're going to use the higher total pumping number rather than discount for septic, which is what ecology typically allows. Although I think in an aquifer stack, you can't assume that that surface septic is going to get all the way back down to the point of extraction, point of withdrawal of the well.
Good question. Thank you.
All right, thank you.